Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, pretty baby, since you left me, I have been feeling oh so blue. I always thought that you would love me. I don't know what I should do. Do do. I always thought that you would love me. I always thought that you'd be true. And now I'm sad you're feeling lonely. I don't know what I should do. Do do ba ba da do da. Do do ba ba da do.
A good, good, and blessed Saturday evening to each and every one of you. Thank you so much for joining me here again on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. I am your humble host, Maria Wong. And we're going to jump right into our show because tonight we have a very, very special guest. Tonight I'm welcoming Chitoka Webb to Healing Through Hurt. And she is a powerhouse female entrepreneur and author, and she wrote a book titled Something Inside of Me, How to Hang On to Heaven When You're Going Through Hell. And let me give you a little bit of background on this dynamic young lady. Chitoka Webb is a successful business owner, motivational speaker, and author who lives in Hendersonville, Tennessee. Raised by her single mother, Ms. Webb grew up in the Preston Taylor housing projects, landed her first job in a grocery store at the age of 13 years old. When a senior in high school, she was told by the school authorities that she couldn't graduate with her class just a week before the ceremony due to the being one point short in her chemistry class. Now in her mid-30s, Ms. Webb owned several businesses that she founded. She began her self-employed career at 23 in 1999. Ms. Webb left Nashville and moved to Atlanta, where she nurtured numerous relationships with professional athletes and successful business people. Working as the only female barber alongside 14 other male barbers, her highlight moment came during Super Bowl 34 when she was invited by her client, Anthony Dorsett, who happens to be the son of football great Tony Dorsett, to attend the event as their barber. After much success in accomplishing set goals, she returned to Nashville in pursuit of a dream to own her own barbershop, which she opened in October of 2001. She worked three full-time jobs for 3 months to make this dream a reality. Some of Ms. Webb's successes include being appointed by the governor of Tennessee as a board of trustee to a state-appointed board, a member for the Nashville Juvenile Justice Center, president of the Nashville Chamber of Commerce Business Council, and being elected to the prestigious Entrepreneurs Organization. Webb currently volunteers as an auditor for the Nashville United Way and serves as a board member for the Middle Tennessee YMCA. And as you all can see and hear, this is somebody who you really do want to get to know. So with that said, we're going to welcome Chitoka to Healing Through Hurt.
Hello, good evening. How are you?
I'm blessed, and how are you? And I'm just so glad that you decided to join me here on Healing Through Hurt, because I tell you, when I sat down to read your book, you know, a lot of things that you said hit home, and you know, I just jotted down so many little notes about some of the things that you said that I think that our listeners will enjoy taking from tonight's interview. So, again, to all of our callers on the call query, thank you so much for joining us. Naturally, if you would like to speak with Jatoka, please press the number one on your phone, and I will be more than happy to bring you on air with her. If not, then just sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And I just opened our chat room. So hopefully, welcome to our guests in the chat room. And, of course, if you have a question or comment, feel free to call in at 646-478-4726. And for the guests in the chat room, if you're in as a guest, please log in if you'd like to type a question or comment, and then I would be more than happy to read it for you on air. Okay, with that said, we're going to jump right in to Something Inside of Me, How to Hang On to Heaven When You're Going Through Hell. So, I guess we can really start at the very beginning.
Well, first I wanted to say thank you for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss with you how to hang on to heaven when you're going through hell, which is almost equal to the title of your show, which is Healing Through Hurt. But it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to it. So I'm ready to jump in wherever you'd like for me to start.
Thank you so much. We can go back to, you know, as I told you when we were speaking briefly before the show, was that in the beginning, when you were small, let's tell us a little bit about growing up in that particular project and how life was with you and your mom. And I know by at that time you already knew that you were, you know, at that age, we just think we're made to believe that we're different. We don't know that that different just means that we're special. So, you know, just bring us up to date a little bit about your childhood and growing up with that difference, as we'll call it.
Okay. Well, I was born in the Preston Taylor Housing Projects in December the 18th, 1974, in those housing projects. Are located on the west side of Nashville, and it's really an interesting time in my life to explain or discuss with you, because there were so many things about that life that I did not really realize until I got older. And what I mean by that, you know, when we were younger, of course we were poor, and there never seemed to be enough money, you know, for anything. But early on, my mother taught us how to make do with, you know, with what we had. And when I was younger, I did not realize we were as poor as we were, really, until I got older. And so growing up in the housing projects, one of the reasons why I wanted to mention it in my book, because, of course, you know, with watching television, the housing projects it gets a bad rep, because you think of drugs, you think of murderers, you think of all these horrible things that happen, you know, within the housing projects, and there's never a mention of any of the good things that happen. And for a young lady such as myself, who is now, you know, an entrepreneur, business owner, and author, a lot of the lessons that I live by are the lessons that I learned when we lived in the projects. Something as simple as, you know, learning how to share, and, you know, when someone would give you something, learning how to say thank you. One of the things that my mother used to teach my sister and I, because at the time it was just my sister, it was myself and my oldest sister. And one of the things that she was adamant about, I mean, I promise you, it seemed like I heard it every day, and that was to treat people the way that you want to be treated. And she actually said it so much that, you know, when I got older, I actually thought it was a law. And I didn't realize that it was not a law until, you know, of course, until I got older. But the beauty in that is I learned early on how to be considerate of other people's feelings, other people's thoughts. It, that wasn't work for me to, you know, be patient with others and be considerate of others. And it was a challenging time in the sense that, you know, when I think back on some of the memories that I have of my mother expressing emotions, it was, she done it more when we lived in the projects than when we got older. You know, those were some of the, you know, the first times that I had seen her cry, or maybe seen her really quiet, and, you know, whatever the case may be, because even though we lived in the projects, we had a strict schedule. We had to be in the house before it got dark, and even in the morning times when we went outside, we had to, you know, we had to stay on the porch, or, you know, we could never be out of her eyesight. So even though we lived in an environment where there was a lot of crime and, you know, a lot of things that were going on that was not good, my mother really protected us. And so, and it's so interesting because I think, thinking back on my own situation, everything, it really does start in the home, because even though we were in that, I mean, we were right there in the midst of the environment, but, you know, I have two older sisters, and I'm sorry, two sisters, one is older and one is younger. There's never been an issue with prostitution. There's never been an issue with drugs and alcohol and crime and things of that nature. And even though we were right in the midst of it, we didn't take up those personalities and those attitudes and those habits, because within our home, my mother wasn't having that. And so it really does, you know, kind of all start, you know, at the home. But excuse me, I'm really glad that I had the opportunity to share that in the book, because I also wanted to highlight, and I did highlight some of the women in the first chapter of my book, some of the women in the housing projects who taught us, you know, just simple things, and some of the things that they would do that, I mean, you really don't see anymore. I think there's one story that I tell about, you know, seeing the police a lot, you know, whether they were coming to do a drug raid or bust something up, or, you know, go in someone's house and they're looking for someone or whatever the case may be, it would be nothing, you know, to be a small child and see the police, four or five police running in front of you, and they're chasing this black guy. And, you know, you would see women, especially the older women, some of them that you may not even see during the week, you know, and they would, you know, they would have their heads pressed against the windows, and, you know, and at the whole time they're looking, you can look at the expression on their face and see that they were praying to the good Lord that they didn't catch him and kill him. So, right. You know, I've learned, as simple and as minute as that may seem, even at, you know, I'm 36 years old now, and ever since I was a child, I learned to pray for people in crisis. You know, if I was at, you know, on the interstate and driving by and I saw maybe a car was flipped over, maybe someone had an accident, even in passing, I learned how to pray for other people. So there was a lot of lessons that I learned, you know, growing up in the housing projects that I will forever be grateful for.
And, you know, I think that so many people don't understand that concept of being grateful, because most people, that, you know, in this day and age, we're in this me first society, and people live in these big posh homes, and, you know, they think that they have arrived, and they forget the struggles that some people came through, and even those that have come along before us. You know, just yesterday we buried, like, one of the family historians. She was 92 years old, and, you know, and everything that we didn't get before she left is gone, but I know that she was one of the original, one of the true, you know, strong black women out there. And nowadays, young people, or people in general, have forgotten what it was like, because some of these children are born into the big fancy homes and they don't know what struggle is yet. And, you know, not saying that I pray that they ever will, but in this economy, a lot of people that had everything now have nothing. So, you know, what you're saying brings, you know, some type of, brings it into the real world, because I do believe that people need to hear and understand, especially young people, that there is another side to that rainbow. And, you know, they need to understand that what goes up, you know, eventually may come down. So,
And from what I've learned from my experiences, it's really best to learn it on your own, because it's nothing like when you have to learn a situation and you find yourself, you know, not only, you know, being tortured by the pain of the situation, but when you find yourself in that particular position and you have to admit and say to yourself, I knew better. I should have never done that. And I learned early on, I think it was probably in my teens, maybe early 20s, that I couldn't take that kind of disappointment for myself. Like, I'll give you an example. I had a cousin, I think he was in my early 20s, and I knew that, you know, he was up to no good. I knew that, you know, he had, you know, misused and abused the things that his mother had given, his grandmother had given, his aunt. You know, it would be nothing for him to, you know, tell his mother, well, I'm going to step outside and use your cell phone and, you know, not come back for weeks with her cell phone. And so I remember one day, I think I was at my grandmother's house, and he said he was going to run to the store. And I was hesitant, and something inside of me said, don't do it. And but, of course, you know, there's always that second voice that said, well, you know, it's just a block over, no big deal. Well, he was gone for a day. You know, and I remember that whole night, I think I was more disgusted and upset with myself because I knew better. I knew that that was one situation that I had voluntarily, you know, really put myself in. So I would hope, you know, like you, with the young folks, surely, of course, we don't want anything terrible, you know, to happen to them. But I think we also want them to know that a lot of things you can learn on your own. You don't have to hit hell and hit rock bottom first. You know, there are some things that you can learn, and I think that's the purpose of me writing this book and the purpose of you having the show, is so that people can learn from our mistakes versus learning from their own.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's hard sometimes because I'm sure that – well, I know from reading your book, you met with opposition. And I still come across opposition because some people don't understand why, you know, I have to talk about what I've gone through or bring up things of a personal nature because they don't feel as though there's any place for it in what I do. But, you know, again, we have to tell our story in order to help someone else. Before they have to learn it, as the old folks used to say, learn it the hard way, you know.
Right.
A hard head makes a soft behind. Is that how they used to say it? But you know, it's the odd part is how so many people oppose you day in and day out. And I know at some point we'll get to that in the book where you were talking about how people just, you know, accused you of things or came up against you just because. You could just live and breathe, and it would upset some folks just because you are who you are and you do your own thing and you have your goals. And for all of our listeners, when you get your copy of the book, you will see that this is a young lady who stuck to her guns. And don't get me wrong, it's not an easy road. And some days you will feel like giving up, and you may backstep a little bit, but as long as you don't go all the way back to square one, you can still hurry along and get back to where you need to be. So, you know, a lot of times people don't realize that, and they end up just giving up. And in society, that's what a lot of people want you to do. They want to see you fail. They want to see you give up because you always can tell who your true friends are and people who believe in you is when you need them, because as long as you're on that upward swing, they're right there waiting for their taste or their part in all of it to get their freebie. But the minute that you need that push, suddenly they're gone. And it's those one or two people that are still there.
Right. And, you know, that's an interesting point I'd like to join you on. because I found in my decision to never give up and always move forward that it also works both ways. You know, you were saying about, you know, when you have it going on and, you know, you're doing very well, you have those group of people that will cling with you. I also found in my own experience that it's the same when you don't have nothing. And so, you know, I think Oprah has a quote that it's not about finding a person who will ride with you in a limo, but the person who will walk with you when the bus breaks down. So it's having someone who can be okay with you as a person, wherever you are in life, whether you're on a low or whether, you know, you're on a high, just finding someone who can accept you for who you are and, you know, what your journey is all about. And it's tough, you know. It's tough because once you start and you decide and you make a decision to never give up, you just be amazed at the people who are not going to be there for you, who you think are going to be there for you. And that's another thing that I touch on and write about in the book. You know, when I'd moved to Atlanta and I had, you know, had made some wonderful changes, I had made some great progress, and then I moved back to Nashville, and I found myself back in the right back in the same position. And I forced myself to look at myself in the mirror because I wanted to see the reaction on my face when I said to myself, God, I don't want to live like this anymore. Whatever I have to do to get out of this, I want to get out of this. And when I was watching myself in the mirror, I saw the face of a woman who was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And it's nothing more, I think, encouraging than being sick and tired, you know, being sick and tired of being sick and tired of yourself, you know, because sometimes we put ourselves in these positions and we know that we should not do it. And so as I, you know, did that day, I remember saying to myself, the only way you are going to be able to embrace change and hang on to it is that you're going to have to understand that change is personal. And I think sometimes when we're trying to change or transition from a situation, for some reason we cannot either imagine or accept that in the midst of that change, it may just be us. It may not be, you know, your mama, your brother, your sister, your uncle. In some cases, if you have adult children, it's not even your children. You know, sometimes that, you know, when that change, when it transitions, sometimes it's just for you.
Yeah, exactly. And let me move along a little bit on that subject because, again, for all of our listeners, especially those that are trying to get into the chat room, we are working on that issue. In the event that you cannot hear the show, try to reboot the chat room, and you should be able to come back online. And to all of our guests in the query, of course, press the number one on your phone if you'd like to be on air, if you have a question or comment. Once again, our guest this evening is Jatoka Webb. She is a dynamo in the world of entrepreneurship, and she is also the author of Something Inside of Me, How to Hang On to Heaven When You're Going Through Hell. We have started off with talking about coming up on, as they used to say, the rough side of the mountain. And then I think that, let me ask you this, because that brought up a good point. I was just thinking about the old song, I'm coming up on the rough side of the mountain. And when you come up on that rough side, when you reach the top, it's just more satisfying or rewarding because you know that when you got to the top, you know that you worked yourself to the bone to get there. And that makes that reward more, it makes you more appreciative. And you look back on that blessing of coming up on that rough side. Because there's nothing worse, I think, than so many people having, as they say, that silver spoon in their mouth and having that easy ride. And then the minute that
they reach where they think they should be, if for some reason they start to roll back down the hill, they'll have no clue what to do. But you come up on that rough side, so you know what to do when you hit those little bumps along the way, even if for some reason you start to fall back down. And, you know, that in itself says so much that, again, people don't seem to understand these days. And one part in the book, and I know we were talking about this before the show started, was how we're going back to your childhood a bit, because as I told you, I experienced this a lot too, and I'm sure some of our listeners can relate to it, when there's always at least one person who was that antagonist in school, that person that just was always wanted to get everyone else to dislike you because they didn't like you. And, you know, the one thing that you spoke about in the book was that so many times that person would tell you, whether it was you spoke proper and you talk like a white girl, or I think at one point in the book you had said that she even brought up that you ate like a white girl because you chose an apple over chips.
Right.
And you know, it's amazing that it's these little things, and this still goes on now. You know, kids will make fun of you because you're eating a salad as opposed to fatty, greasy foods and a whole bunch of stuff that's just going to clog your arteries. And
right.
You know, it is so amazing that we're 11 years apart in age. So, you know, we'll just say that I'm a decade older than you. So it happened in my time, it happened in your time, and it's still happening now. So
right.
I love the fact that we come together. And as long as it's continuing to happen, there's still going to be people like yourself and me even. That's going to keep speaking out against it. And we're not necessarily speaking out in a way that's negative or defensive. We're speaking out to educate and to enlighten people to the fact that this has been going on from generation to generation to generation. And somewhere, if we help one person, then it's a job well done, because that person will then help another who may help another and another. And if it keeps going, it's going to grow. So
that's
you know, as much as we can say, it would be wonderful if we could heal the world. But you know what? If we heal half of the world, then it's still a job well done. So you know,
I totally agree with that, because I actually, in that particular chapter, I share, you know, about being different and how, you know, I could go both. With my mom, I have an older sister and a younger sister, and those are the two sisters that I grew up with. And I'm of a darker skin, and they're light skin. And so, you know, growing up, it would be nothing for, you know, I have this one particular uncle, and, you know, he'd walk up to me and say, "Girl, you sure is pretty to be so black." You know, and then he'd walk, after he'd say that, he'd go to my sister, who's lighter skin, and say, "Girl, you still pretty." And I could never figure out, why couldn't I just be pretty? You know, why did I have to be, you know, you so black, you know, but you're still pretty, like being black is ugly or something. And one of the other reasons why I wanted to share that in our book is because, as an African-American woman, one thing that annoys me to death is how oftentimes our race will put expectations on other races and other people around the world that they treat us with dignity and respect, and we don't even treat ourselves like that. And I wrote about it because it's prevalent in, you know, African-American households, it's common, and it's tolerated. And I wanted to speak about it and to share it, so that even if you're an adult, whether you're lighter skin or dark skin or whatever, if you see another adult saying that to a child, call that adult out and say in front of that child, "Don't say that to her." Because what some adults, especially the ignorant ones, don't understand is that these children carry these words. They don't carry them because, you know, they're having an old pity me party. We're human. And when you're human and someone says something to you, something that is confusing, something that is disturbing, something that is you know, degrading, you are going to remember that. You know, and also it allowed me to see visually how what we consider to be pretty and what we consider to be ugly. Now, how can we as a race demand that other people treat us with this dignity and respect, and we don't even treat each other like that? To me, that is like, that's so ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous. And so that particular and one of the other reasons why I really, really loved writing about it and sharing it is because you can grow past that. You know, it wasn't until I got older, I got to high school and then out of high school and became a business owner that I realized there are so many different races. No one focuses on how dark someone is. I mean, you know, it's only those kinds of things are only captured when you are in a setting where a person has a poverty mentality. And a poverty mentality is not about the amount of money that you have in your pocket. It's about the amount of trash that you have in your mind. And so, but I really, really enjoyed, you know, sharing that because as a young child, you know, you think that different means that it's something bad or, you know, maybe you just can't get it right. Because I write about that as well, you know, becoming frustrated with myself because it seems like I could not escape it, you know, whether I went to church, whether I went to a family picnic, whether I went to, you know, a friend's house, I could not escape it. But the beauty in that story, that's actually chapter 2. And the title of that chapter is The Loneliness of Being Different. But the story ends with me sharing with the readers all of these things that happened to me as a child. You know, I had a friend. You know, not only did I have issues with the black kids, I had issues with the white kids. You know, it just seems like I couldn't escape it. But the story ends with me killing a bumblebee and how it was not until the bumblebee stung me that I realized that I'm still responsible for my actions and how I treat people regardless of the things that they've done to me. Mm-hmm. And so, but I really enjoyed the story because it pains me to see so many young kids killing themselves you know, because they're being bullied. And it's so interesting because as an adult, I can watch on television and see you have the kid that's being bullied, then you have the kid that kills themselves because they're being bullied. Being a person who is different, I can look at those two children and know that the one who's doing the bullying is insecure, they don't like the way they look, and they're jealous of the one that's being bullied. It's really obvious. And I'm glad that you enjoyed the story.
I did because many times I would sit down with my daughter-in-law and I'd tell her, you know, growing up for me, even now, it's still you certainly are cute to be dark. And I'm like, well, what exactly should a dark-skinned woman look like? What is your version of a dark-skinned woman? Or I'll get, where are you from? You have exotic features. And I'm like, what does that mean? Black people don't have high cheekbones. They don't have smaller lips. I mean, I'm confused. They don't have skin that doesn't have a lot of blemishes on it. I'm dark, of a darker hue. But, you know, and in the same breath, the people that do not look like me think that I'm one of the most beautiful people in the world. But the people who I'm supposed to be a part of don't see that.
Yes. And that's so interesting.
You know, it's just so amazing that, you know, reading your book, and I said, you know, it's crazy. It's still going on. And then I will tell you this, and you know, we're not just saying that it happened to us. We're talking about us as a race and how we are a most self-loathing, self-hating bunch of people because My daughter-in-law happens to be extremely fair-skinned, you know, with the hair down her back. I always joke about her and her long, lustrous hair, you know, and the whole nine yards. And, you know, it's a bit sad because, you know, she has her stories to tell. And it's like, well, wow, well, what's the problem here? You don't like me because I'm black. You don't like her because she's fair-skinned. You know,
you can't win.
You cannot win no matter how we do it. We cannot win. So, you know, and then, you know, when you're dealing with children, who are, one's very light, or one may take after daddy, one may take after mommy, and then, you know, at a certain age, they want to know, well, why can't I look like you all look? Or why can't I be? Because they're already, the seed is already being planted that it means something to be of that lighter hue. It means something, you know, that they, and they're starting already to feel as though they're a child of a lesser God because it's already in them. And there's a movie coming out. I don't know if you've seen the promo for it that's geared towards dark-skinned women. And, you know, the majority of the people on it are dark-skinned women, and it was so disheartening to hear the stories because it was like, wow, I went through that too. And I'm 47, and I still get people that make comments when they're in their, you know, the heightened of their ignorance mode, you know, they're just, I'm like, really? Really?
Yeah.
You know, if I could just touch them and then spread it to them and make them look like, bing, you know, it's like, how you like me now? Welcome to my world.
You know, but I guess in, you know, exploring the fact that all of us are different in some kind of way, even those people who look at people who are of a darker skin, they're all, there are also people who are envious and jealous of those that are lighter skin. So, and I think that is another thing that one of the reasons why I'm really proud of my book is because I think some of the messages are so universal, you know, and as I was explaining to you before we went on air, anytime you are striving to do better in life, anytime you're striving to become a better person on the inside, you are always going to encounter some kind of adversity. Always. It doesn't, I mean, even if you take Peyton Manning, for instance, you know, he was born into you know, a very well-to-do family, very prominent family. His father is, you know, one of the football greats. But even still, he encountered adversity. And it's interesting because adversity gives us something that nothing – adversity gives us something that joy can't give us. It gives us, it gives us something that reward can't give us. Adversity gives us something different. And I think what that difference is, I think it's a remember when kind of reward. And, you know, when I look back over my life, you know, I remember being a young girl growing up in the housing projects. And I remember, you know, just thinking, you know, when I would go to school and you see kids that have, you know, a mother and a father and, you know, the dad picking them up, the dad holding, you know, the young girl or the young boy in their arms, or kids with new shoes and new clothes. And I used to always feel like, well, why can't I have that? You know, but now that I'm older, I realize that your life is created and your life is designed according to the outcome of whatever your plan, whatever the plan that God has for you. It's almost like if you think about a football game, you know, they design each NFL team before they even go on the field. They have a plan, and the plan is designed for them to win that play and to win that game. So once you become comfortable with your plan, you develop the confidence and the courage that you need to live it out. You know, even, you know, being 36 years old, it took me a long time, I mean a really long time, to accept the fact that I was different.
It took me a long time to accept that, because when I grew up, that difference that was within me, it wasn't nurtured. It wasn't rewarded. You know what I'm saying? And so as I got older and, you know, my life began to evolve and my, you know, level of awareness began to evolve, I began to realize that the most beautiful thing you can be in the world is to be yourself. And there's really no, I mean, even if you think about it from a broader perspective, there's really no such thing as really being different. You're just being who you were created to be. And I also write about this in the book. I mean, no matter what you do, how you try to dress it up or how you try to portray yourself to be something you're not, your true soul and the spirit that is within you, it will always shine forth. Always shine forth. You know, I'll give you an example. And not to really, you know, tear into this, but I'll just give you an example. It's like if you have a man that's married to a woman, you know, and then he comes out 10 years later and he says, well, you know, I'm gay. Well, I'm sure that's not a big shock to a lot of people that knew him. I mean, you know what
right.
I'm saying? So you can't hide who you are. It will always, if you are a thief, if you are a gossiper, or if you're someone who demeans people and tears people down, if you are a good person, I mean, you take Oprah Winfrey. I think she's a good example. You look at all those years that people talked about her, they lied about her, they made fun of her, they tried to tear her down, but the good that was within her, you could see it. You know what I'm saying? All of the good that's within you, it will shine forth. And I think that that's probably a good place to start for anyone. I mean, you know, anyone who wants to, you know, change their life, or they want to experience, you know, a greater sense of life, you know, compared to where they are now, the first thing that you have to do is you have to accept who you are and be okay with that.
And exactly, and you have to embrace who you are without any, you know, you don't want to feel bad about it. Don't be embarrassed to be who you are, because so many people, and I say this all the time, every day they get up and before they leave their homes or wherever, they put that mask on. And many times people don't realize that people already see through the mask.
Right.
You know, you're not fooling anyone but yourself, or those people that are so blind that they are that gullible and they just don't want to see what's happening right before them. And, you know, and even for the, like the example that you use, you know, 10 years down the road, you figure out, you know, he tells you that he's gay. It's like 10 to 1, you probably saw what everybody else saw anyway.
Right.
But he chose to ignore it because, oh, heaven forbid, you know, what is in the dark comes the light. But, you know, I always tell people, you know, people will always gravitate towards the negative. It's easy. There will be negative statements and comments about you will pass along quicker than anything positive in many cases. That's when you have to have that wherewithal and that tenacity to keep fighting and moving forward. Take that negativity and use it as a positive force to keep you moving where you have to be. And what's the statement in your book? It was, if you're willing to work, what was it? If you're willing to work two extra, how'd it go? I know you know what I'm talking about.
Are you talking about working the extra jobs?
Yes, if you're willing to work two extra jobs, something about your friends.
I think I know what you're talking about. To start my first barbershop, I had to work three full-time jobs. I did that for 3 months. And I remember one of my mentors at the time said that if you live like, what did he say? He said, if you live like your friends won't, for 2 years, you can live like they can't for the rest of your life.
The rest of your life. That's it. That's the statement.
You know, Exactly. So basically, in other words, if you're willing to, and that's exactly what I did. Even I didn't do it for 2 years. I actually did it for a year because I only lived in Atlanta for a year. Instead of going out and buying my lunch and, you know, every Friday, because it's really easy to spend, you know, money when you are a barber because you're making hundreds of dollars a day. So for a year, instead of going out and, you know, to restaurants and eating lunch, I would always, you know, pack my lunch up in a brown paper bag and take my lunch to work. I wore the same clothes, you know, for a year. Of course, I washed them and cleaned them. But right. I wore the same clothes for a year. And I lived a very, you know, lived a very frugal life, and it paid off for me. And one of the other things that was really, I feel like I've been very fortunate is that even though outside of my mom and my family, I did not have a lot of, you know, examples of, you know, what was good and what was right. I have been fortunate to have a lot of mentors and spiritual advisors and, you know, things of that nature. And even with the first barbershop that I ever worked in Nashville, Tennessee, was a barbershop owned by a lady by the name of Tanya. And the name of that barbershop was Tanya's Barbershop. And I'm really, you know, especially now that I'm older and I've went through some things and, you know, I've had several businesses, I'm really grateful that that's the first and only barbershop that I worked in, because she, not only was she a barber, she was a businesswoman. So, you know, she didn't splurge money, and, you know, she had health insurance and, you know, savings accounts, and she took care of her business. And that's really unheard of as a barbershop owner. And so I was grateful, you know, just to come up, you know, with so many different people showing me the ropes, you know, along the way. But that does not alleviate you doing the hard work. I think one of the other things that I talk about in my book is that, you know, prayer is not a substitute for hard work. You know, right. For some reason, everyone is looking for this quick fix to get to, you know, these places in life, and there is nothing, and I do mean nothing, that can substitute hard work. You can pray 8 hours, you can pray 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but if you don't work, you're not going to get there. You know, you can get loans, you can get favors, whatever the case may be. But if you don't work hard, you right. are not going to get there. And earlier we were speaking about young people. I think that's probably one of the biggest tragedies with the young today who are not doing anything in their lives. And I also like to, you know, when I'm talking about, you know, people or, you know, men, women, young people or whatever, I always like to make sure that, you know, I make it clear that I don't mean all young people, because there's a lot of young people out there that are doing great things, that are, you know what I'm saying, they're doing great things in their community, they're abiding by the laws, they're getting an education, they're just doing wonderful things. I'm talking about the ones who are not. And, right. you know, you have to work hard, and there's just no way around it, you know. And I think that we put so much emphasis just on just go to school. Well, it's more to life than just going to school, you know, because after going to school and getting that degree or getting that education, you're going to have to learn some work ethic. I cannot tell you as a business owner how, what's the word, how disappointed I was to see so many younger people in their late teens and early 20s and mid-20s. You know, they have these PhD degrees, master's degrees, and some of them have 3 and 4 and 5 of them. But they don't know how to ride to work on time. They don't know how right. to speak to a customer on the telephone. They don't know the appropriate attire to wear, you know, to a business interview. I actually had a gentleman to come and do an interview. Just so happened, I just actually walked in on the interview. One of the managers was interviewing this young man, and he went from talking about what school he went to, you know, well, I sell clothes, I sell glasses, I got some out in the car. And I'm thinking, this is an interview. You know, this is not the flea market. So, I mean, learning how to work hard You know, when you do that, you learn more than just how to work hard. You learn so many different work ethics that you're going to need now and later on down the road.
Exactly. And, you know, it was so funny that you brought up the young man who was in the interview, and then he decides to start talking about, I do this and I do that. You know, I always say that people, whether you be a young person just starting out or whether you be a seasoned adult, you need to know the business of your business before
mm-hmm.
you even get into a business. And
right.
I always say that I do this little skit with my young people that I work with, and I say, okay. I said, this is what I want you to do. You're going to put on this suit and tie, and you're going to go into this interview, and you're going to be you're expressing yourself and wear your pants hanging down to the ground and all this, getting in, be yourself. And in the end, it's so amazing that, okay, which one would you prefer to hire? You know, and they might laugh and joke, but they say, you know, I'd rather hire, you know, the one that comes in the tie and the suit. So, and I always tell them, I said, okay, so you're telling me you wouldn't hire yourself because you guys beat me down that you should have the right to dress the way you want and do what you want to do. When you're off the clock and when you're on your time, you do whatever you want to do. But when you're going into that interview, if you want a job, if you don't want something more than working minimum wage in a blue-collar job, and I'm not knocking blue-collar jobs. That's not what I'm saying. But most of these young people have these high expectations and aspirations. You're not going to get it if you come in and you're not in proper attire and you're not speaking and articulating what it is that you have to say. And the point you're trying to get across. Because if you can't sell yourself to yourself, you certainly will not be able to sell yourself to anyone else.
Right. That's right. That's a good point. That's right. That's an excellent point. And you have to, you know, as you're going along this journey that we're all on, you have to really learn that all of it is your responsibility. And that's one of the things I know I talk about from the beginning of the book to the end of the book. Even, you know, in the chapters where I talk about losing my vision, you know, for some reason I thought because I was sick and I wasn't able and I was blind and I could not see that God would make choices for me. And it just dawned on me one day that, no, I will not, you know, I'll give you the information and I'll give you the resources, but I will not make the choice for you, Shatoka. You have to make choices for yourself. And I think that, you know, we go through these different things in life and these different phases, and we think that God is going to make a choice for us. He's not. He's not. It's never going to happen. Will it always provide a sense of comfort so that you'll understand that you're not alone? Sure, he will. Will it always provide resources so you will know how to get from this point to the next point? Sure, he will. Will he tell you, okay, now it's time for you to go, you need to do this? No, you have to make that. He'll make you aware of it, but you have to make that choice for yourself. And so that is another thing that I learned growing up in the housing project. By my mother teaching me that one particular principle about treating people the way that you want to be treated, she never said if they're nice to you. She never said, well, if they give you a quarter. You know, she never said, well, if this little girl lets you ride her bicycle, you treat her the way that you want to be treated. It was always, you treat people the way that you want to be treated. And so once you learn that one principle, whether you're a young person or whether you are an adult, you learn that the message and that particular principle is you are responsible for your life. You know, there's a, I can't remember who actually quotes it, but there's a quote that says, what people do to me is their karma, but what I do to them is my karma. And so no matter how you look at it, everything that you do in life is going to come back around one way or the other.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I hope that, you know, this show will be, of course, to all of our listeners. This show will be in our archive, so you can come back and visit it often. And feel free to pass it along to your friends because, you know, our tagline for this show is real people, real stories, real hurt, real healing. And this year I added real raw because, there's no sugarcoating here. It is what it is. When you were speaking about, you know, God and hell, I think that a lot of people, like so many people say, I'm waiting on God. God will send this perfect man to me or this perfect woman, and God will do this. And I always think that, well, you guys seem to be taking the low road and the easy way out. So when it doesn't happen, you can say, well, God didn't want it to happen. No, God probably had that man out there walking past you 27,000 times, but because you sat inside of the house with the curtains drawn and the door closed and you never ventured out to see where he was, then
right. That's
not God's fault, it's yours. And I think that people like to find something that's, I believe you mentioned it in the book, something that's easy for them to believe.
That's
to
right.
Justify why they're not doing what they know they need to do, whether it be successful, whether it be to finish that painting that they started or write a book or follow their dreams, whatever. It's so easy for somebody to create their own reality
right. That
makes sense to them instead of them looking at life as a face value that it is. So,
right. You
know, it's just so amazing that, we tend to ignore answers that are right in front of us and use poor God gets blamed for everything. And it's like God gave us something called free will and good sense and the drive
right. To
want to do.
Right.
He didn't say just sit here, lay in the bed, and I'm just going to keep bringing all these miracles to you. You're lazy, unmotivated butt, and I'm just going to keep giving you blessings. No, he gave us legs and feet so that we could put one foot in front of the other and walk towards our goals.
Right.
He didn't just
say, that's true. And something else I'd like to add to that is really important, well, at least I think it is that you're not always going to be here. You know, one of the things that I think of quite often, especially like when I'm in a large, within a large group, last week I was in New York. I went to the Book Expo of America convention there at the Javits Center. And, you know, you have, you know, so many people that are of importance and so many everyday people and, you know, all your publishers, your literary agents, you know, your authors, all the people that make up the book world. And, you know, I kind of stood there and thought to myself, you know, what I know for sure is that in 100 years, all of us will be dead. Every last one of us in here will be dead. And that is it brings it all way back down to reality. You know, this very moment that we have right now is the most important moment in the world. And you don't know if you're going to wake up tomorrow. You know, another thing that I try to be mindful of, and not that I'm trying to spook anybody, I'm just trying to make them aware, because we live in, you know, I wrote a poem called Thick Skin Winter. And I talk about, you know, tune out the noise and because to me it's like I consider them to be demonic distractions, whether it's, you know, it's the television or the internet or the radio or, you know, some people just they're busybodies. They feel like they have to go and go and go and go and go and go, and they have to do something every Saturday, do something every Sunday. They're just all over the place. And, you know, one thing that I try to be mindful of is that you never know what death is. You know, I don't know if after I finish talking to you, if you know, death's going to call my name. You know, the one thing that I do know for sure is that for every one of us that's living, there's a different place for us that has our name on it. And I think that should within itself make people or allow people to engage a certain level of awareness where, you know, this is all the time that you have.
You know, it's all the time that you have. So why not make the best of it? You know, why not try to do something different? Why not try to, you know, to do something better? If you weigh 900 pounds, you know, if you had a hamburger and 15 bags of fries at 5 o'clock, if at 5:15 you make a decision that I'm never going to eat like that again, don't you know you just changed your life? You know, if you are in an abusive relationship, like we talked about, you know, earlier, you know, if you had a moment where you were abused at 5 o'clock and at 5:05, you said, I am never going to live like this again. I'm never going to allow someone to treat me like this again. You have just changed your life. And I think that's the beauty in changing. I think that's the beauty in having the power to change, is that it can be right now, at least the beginning of it.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, it's so amazing how time flies. We have less than an hour left in this show.
Oh, boy.
You know, this is what happens when the talking gets good. Oh, my goodness, time tends to fly. But we're going to move it up a little bit. I did want to talk about one small thing because, I had found a picture of you, and I believe they were, I'm assuming that they are your three Spaniels. And I have to talk a little bit about chocolate because, you know, I'm a big fan of rescue. So I love my little, now I have a little teeny tiny chihuahua, and she's a rescue, and, you know, I love me some Trixie. But and I know when you were speaking about chocolate, you know, I just, when I was reading along, I didn't know what was coming up, but I thought that maybe, because, you know, when you had gone to work, I believe, and you left, you wanted chocolate to be outside on the deck or the balcony. And I said, okay. And then I know that at that point, because I know that that was one of those points where I thought maybe, you know, you were hanging around and chocolate was part of it. And when you got the infamous notification that chocolate was gone. You know, we're just going
to
touch on that.
Even to this day, it's still painful.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, it's painful to me because when I found out from reading the book what had happened, it's still right here. Even when I'm talking about it, I can still almost picture it. Because many years ago, we had a cocker named Toby. And love Toby to death. So, you know, it's... yeah, that part was real for me. And, again, I felt your pain on that one. And to our guests, of course, that are listening, I'm here with Chautauqua Webb. She is the author of Something Inside of Me, How to Hang On to Heaven When You're Going Through Hell. This lady is someone who literally came a very long way. And for those of you who think, oh, well, I came from poverty and I came from this and I came from a broken home and I came from a single parent home and I can't do this and I can't do that, the bottom line is that's something called an excuse. Because there are many of us who came from one parent home who have become successful. And so far tonight we have spoken about being different and embracing you're different because some people, you know, if you look at the life of bees, some bees are born to be workers, some bees are born to be the soldiers, and then, of course, you have the queen. Some of us are worker bees because we choose to be, because we choose to ignore our true calling. Some of us just choose to be for human purposes, drones, because we just don't want to work hard for anything. We just want whatever life is going to give to us where we have to put in the least amount of effort. So we just exist from day to day to day. We live, we grow old, and then we die. Mm-hmm. But the realization is you too can become successful. And for our last 50-some-odd minutes, we're going to get into Ms. Webb's life and her the trial of you losing your sight. Because when I was reading up on all of that, I was like, what? You know, I'm like, oh, wait.
Yeah, it just kind of popped in the story, right?
Yeah, you know, and I said, wait a minute, huh? And I'm like, what? A film? Milky film? What? And I'm busy touching my eyes and feeling my eyes, like, what?
Yeah, that's how I feel. I felt the same way when it happened.
I was at work the other day, and I was just talking about it, and I said, well, it has no rhyme or reason to it. It just kind of sort of happens. And
right.
It's not, you know, it's not necessarily genetic. It's not environmental. It's all of a sudden you're just walking along, you know, jolly-go-lucky, and then the next thing you know, I'm blind. Hello.
Right. And, you know, I think that it's, you know, when you just said, you know, it's not environmental, it's not genetic, it's not. But I think, well, that was one of the other reasons why I was so adamant about sharing my story is because, again, when you're climbing that ladder, you can't always, even though you can see where you're going, you can see that your efforts are to move you closer to the top, but you can't always see what's coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
And but it does not. There's a, I remember writing in the book, and I think it was something along the lines of, and I stated several times, when you are on a mission, you cannot get all bent out of shape about the process. And sometimes we get so lost in the process that we forget that we're on a mission. Give you an example. I used to have this one assistant that worked for my company years ago. And, you know, someone would give her a task, even if it was to go to the maybe the Office Depot store to pick up paper. And instead of her buying, you know, five bags of paper or a case of paper, she may come back with one bag of paper. And she, I noticed she always had, she talked more about the process, what street she went down, what happened when she went down that street, what happened when she got to the store, what happened when she got on the aisle. But she could never grasp the fact that you did not complete the job. And it's the same way when you're on a mission in life. You can't get all bent out of shape about the process. You have to focus on what that mission is. And that may sound, you know, like a minute statement or a very easy statement to make, but it is the only statement that is real. You have to stay focused. And, you know, once not too long ago, I was doing just some writing freely. And I remember writing down the only difference between the people at the top and the people at the bottom is the people at the top don't give up, because it sure isn't the circumstances and the situations that they go through, because they happen to all of us, and they can happen to any of us at any given time. Just like when I lost my vision, I was 29 years old. I had I had one business where was a barbershop. I had built a new second barbershop, and I had opened my first healthcare company, and I was in the process of actually opening my second one. And I had just bought my first home. I was happy because all those years of hard work, it had paid off. And I knew in my mind that, you know, if I could overcome that, I can overcome this. And that was all I needed to really take off. And just one day, I was in my office and I was completing a report, and an employee walked in and she was looking for some forms. And I remember trying to hurry up and finish typing this report. And when I you know, set out to look up to address her, I could not see her. I literally could not see her. And I remember all of these emotions going through me at one time, like, oh, my God, I'm going blind. And I blinked my eyes, and I rubbed my eyes, and I blinked my eyes and rubbed my eyes again. But I did not want to panic in front of her.
Right.
And so I played it off. You know, I listened for her voice to see, you know, where she was directly, you know, within the room. But I was a mess. I was a nervous wreck. And I remember when she left, I remember really rubbing my eyes and, you know, blinking my eyes really fast. And my sight, it didn't come back. And so I had to learn how to live with, you know, with no vision. And I think it was around October is when my vision, when I completely lost my vision. And that was, not only was it a dark time in life for me, it was very, 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 very painful because the situation was new to me. I had battled poverty. I had battled racism. I had battled, you know, just everyday life situations. But I had never had to battle or fight a battle that was inside of me. And that's a tough one to fight that, you know, that I've learned over the years. Because you have to hold yourself accountable to the same standards and responsibilities that you do other people, meaning that if you take, let's take my uncle, for instance. If I am going to walk this life and live this journey that God has given me and I'm going to live out my purpose, if I'm saying to my uncle, I'm not going to let you degrade me, I'm not going to tolerate you treating me in that manner, and, you know, I am going to have to depart, you know, from your way of thinking. Well, you know what? The same thing holds true when you are battling yourself. You have to tell yourself, I am not going to allow you to think like that. For instance, I remember I went to see a retina specialist. One of the first things he told me is that you will all your sight's not going to come back. You're always going to be blind. I went to another specialist when my vision, you know, was just kind of blurry, but I could see a little bit. And I remember him telling me, you are going to go blind. And the minute that they would say that, I would say to myself, oh, my God, I'm going blind. But I learned how to even talk to my own self. And I started telling myself, Shatoka, you will not talk like that to me. I was almost acting like someone with different personalities. But, hey, if that's what it takes to get you through getting over a situation with yourself, make up 15 personalities. You know, and I would tell myself, Shatoka, you will not talk like that to me. I can see, and I will be able to see again. This is not the end for me. So learning how to confront yourself, learning how to deal with those situations that, you know, that are within you, it's tough, it's difficult, it's challenging. But once you learn how to do it, you will always know how to pick yourself up by the bootstraps. You always know how to make a way out of no way, and you will learn how other people should treat you when you're going through a situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, not only was it a dark moment, it was a tough moment for me because I've never battled myself before. Me and myself had always been on the same team, you know, and here it is. I just could have, I never could have imagined that all those other battles that, you know, I learned, that I fought and, you know, I got over it, I got through it. I never knew that I would need those experiences to learn how to deal with myself. And I believe to this day, even though I've had eye surgeries, I've had eye injections, I've had eye dyes put in my eye, I've had ultrasounds, done on my eyes the same way that you would do on the pregnant woman. You know, they tilted my head back, dropped a big thing of cool, clear gel in my eye and took this instrument that had a warm ball on it and pressed out. I mean, it was horrible, the experiences that I've experienced with my eyes. But just like I write in the book, regardless of whether, you know, if I could see or not, I had to learn that these were my eyes. Whether they were sick or not, they were mine. And it was taking on that responsibility that got me through that situation.
I just want you to know that my face is all cracked up. I'm like, ooh, okay. I'm like, ugh.
Oh, it's
okay. Mm. Well, you know, all jokes aside, though, tell us, what is the name of this particular, because, you know, the odd part is for our listeners is that we know that you just suddenly lost your sight, but in doing this again, if it happens to me, now at least I'll know or I'll have a better idea of, oh, my gosh, maybe I had, you know, I have what, you know, Shatoka had. And I'm like, oh, maybe this is what it is. And so if it happens to me, I won't be as, you know, freaked out over it because I know that, oh, my goodness, maybe this is what she had. So, again, in you sharing this story, it may help the next person because people, again, we don't know when this may, you know, we don't know when this may happen because there's no rhyme or reason to it. You know, there was no particular rhyme. You didn't know that one day you would wake up and be blind.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And, you know, it's I think another thing that's one of the reasons why I try to stay on track with my life because, like earlier when I was talking about, you know, you never know what death is. You never know what sickness is. You never know what bankruptcy is. You know what I'm saying? You never know where rape is. You never know where none of that stuff is. And it could happen to any of us at any time. And, again, I don't say that to spook people. I say that to make you aware so that you can open up your eyes and become more grateful and more thankful of every good and perfect thing that happens to you throughout the day. You know, I've seen so many different times where, you know, a woman, you know, at home with her family, she runs out to the grocery store maybe to get a box of macaroni or something, and she gets murdered. You know, it can happen to any of us. And so not only am I saying that illness can come from around the corner, anything can come, you know, from around the corner. And one of the most challenging things with this disease for me was it was so rare. The disease, I actually have two things going on. I have an eye disease called panuveitis. And that is, uveitis is when the front of the eye is when you have issues with the front of the eye. And there's another one, I can't remember what the name of it is, but it's when you have problems with the middle. But panuveitis is when the whole eye is diseased. And so panuveitis is an eye disease that is usually brought on by an autoimmune disease. And at the time, because this happened in August or September of 2005, and so they knew that I had the panuveitis eye disease, but they did not know which autoimmune disease was causing it. So not only did they treat me for the eye disease, they treated me for the autoimmune disease. And in August of 2008, I got a letter from my doctor at Vanderbilt stating that they had diagnosed me with Behçet's disease. Behçet's disease is a rare, multi-disabling blood disease. And one of the many reasons that I'm very adamant about sharing my story is because with Behçet's being so rare, it's hard to find stories of how people are dealing with it. It's hard to find stories of some of the symptoms that, you know, that people had at the time when I was diagnosed with it. And so I found this website called the American Behçet's Disease Association, and I was so grateful for the few people who took time to go into those chat rooms, to join those particular groups that you can join, and tell what were some of the symptoms that they were having. You know, what happened after they had the symptoms. And when I was diagnosed with the disease, I mean, I had never even thought about this before, but it's even a sense of loneliness that you experience in having a disease that no one in America has. I mean, because in America, I think there's less than 10,000 people with Behçet's disease. It actually originates from Asia, China, and Japan. And I write about this in my book as well. I was like, how in the hell did it get to Nashville, Tennessee to me? You know, right. But again, it just goes to show that when you are, when you've made that assertive effort and you've made that commitment to yourself and to God that, you know what, I'm going to fight this thing, come hell or high water. I don't care whether it's disease, whether it's finances, whether it's family, whether it's society. God, I'm going to fight. And there is a scripture that I had read one time, and it was one of the prophets in the Bible. I'm not really sure who it was. But he was praying to God, and in his prayer he said, God, I will make a run for you. So when you say to yourself, whatever you say to yourself, remember, you're saying it to the universe. So when you say, I will stand up against this, I will stand up against that, I will fight this, I will fight that, you're really saying it to the universe. And when I read that scripture, when that prophet had prayed and said, God, I'll make a run for you, he was saying that because God had made a run for him. And so those are the kind of things, that kind of wisdom that encouraged me to keep on keeping on. And I thought, you know what? I look back over my life. I said, here I am, a little old black girl from Nashville, Tennessee, born in the Preston Taylor Housing Projects. And at 29, I'm on my fourth company. I don't care if I'm blind. I don't care if I lose two legs, two arms, a ear, a lip. It don't matter. I will make a run for God. And so, you know, having that kind of willpower, it comes from knowing some things about God before you get sick, you know. And I think that was the beauty in growing up in the housing projects, because you and I don't know if you grew up in the housing projects, but that's one thing those old folks taught us. You had to go to Bible. You had to go to Sunday school. Even if you didn't pay attention, you had to go to church. You had to sit around and, you know, if someone came to bless, you learn about putting God first, you know. And as I have, you know, evolved, whatever you want to call them is your wish. Whoever it is that you choose to, you know, give that place to, so be it. But the point that I'm making is, and I share this in the book about the two spiritual dreads in the barbershop that I worked in, at Atlanta's Finest Beauty and Barbershop there in Atlanta. That's one of the things that they taught me, and that was that God is supreme intelligence. God is supreme knowledge, right? And so having all this wisdom and all this understanding before I got sick was helpful, and it really taught me that I just couldn't imagine where my life would have ended up if I just didn't know those basic things before that happened to me. But when it happened, I had already made a commitment, come hell or high water, I'm going to beat this thing. And I started saying to myself, I can see. I would say it in the privacy of my own home. I would say it, you know, within my mind. I just kept saying, I was blind as a bat. I couldn't see a thing. But I would tell myself, I can see, I can see, I can see. And I would, you know, maybe go to the grocery store or, you know, because I had a driver to drive me around, or, you know, maybe out in the community. And someone would come up to me and they'd say, well, how are you, Miss Webb? And I could feel them, you know, reaching their hand out. And I would say, hello, I'm fine. I could see. I had programmed my mind to say I can see so much that I even said it after I said good morning or whatever the case may be. But you have to find a way to get through your situation. And I think that you really have to be whole on the inside. You have to be whole mentally and spiritually to get through your situation, because I think sometimes we go through, especially a situation like being abused or being blind or a situation where you lose a loved one or drugs or alcohol or whatever the case may be, you have all these people telling you what you should do. Well, if I was you, I would do this. Well, if I was you, I would do that. You have to get in your own space and find out what is best for you and what do you need to get through that situation. And once you get there and you allow that covering of peace, you allow that covering of understanding, you allow that to embrace you and help you get you through that situation, you can make it.
That's true. That is so true. And, you know, again, I know that at some point you were just so independent. I know that you had tried to drive yourself to the hospital at one point. And I'm like, okay, seriously, a blind woman going down the street trying to drive herself to the hospital. I'm sitting up there like, what are you thinking? But,
right.
I'm like, she's just so in charge and so in control that, oh, it's okay. I'm blind as a bat, but I'll get myself to the hospital. I'm like, okay. But, you know.
And I did.
And that was the kicker in the whole thing. I'm like, oh, my gosh, she got to the hospital.
I did. Like, you know, actually, when that situation happened, and I'm kind of glad you brought that up, because I'm sure when most people read that, they're thinking, well, wow, she was blind. How did she drive to the hospital? Most people who have always had their vision, which is most of us, and have never experienced any kind of issues with vision, most of those people think that being blind is seeing black. But if you look up the word blind, you will find it means not being able to see clearly. So it's not blind in the sense that, you know, I saw black. It's blind in the sense that I couldn't see clearly, which to me is really worse, because there's something in your mind that makes you think, if I squint my eyes a little bit more, if I turn this way, if I look this way, it'll become clear. It's almost like, I know this is probably not a good example, but I'm going to use it anyway. It's almost like taking a piece of crack and putting it on the tip of the nose of a crackhead and tying that crackhead's hands behind, because there's something with, he wants that so bad. There's something within him that thinks he can get it. You follow me? Well, really, if it's not there, it's easy to deal with. And so, losing my vision, you have to understand, for 29 years, I have always had 20/20 vision. That's the best vision you can have. And in that moment, when I looked up and I couldn't see her, I couldn't make out the color of her clothes. I couldn't make out the features, you know, in her face. And so even though I drove myself to the doctor, all these other senses kicked in. Excuse me. And so the other thing that I learned in that moment is that there are so many things that you know, like if you close your eyes right now, you know that if the when you walked in, if the door was to the left, it's still to the left. It's only one door in the room that you're in. I'm just picturing this in my mind. So if the door, if you know the door is to the left when you sit down, if you go blind right now, you're not going to get up and walk to the right. You're going to get up and you're going to walk to the left. And you also have a visual of how you got there before you got to the door. So it was so many things that I learned in that moment that you can use to see. So many things you could use to see. And so all of those things kicked in for me. And as an entrepreneur, I've never had the pleasure or the gift of weighing risk. You know, when you're an entrepreneur at heart, when you feel it, you do it.
Right.
You do it. And by the grace of God, I made it. I made it to the doctor, you know.
I thought, I'm like, okay, she's got this white milky substance across her eyes. Now, for me, I have beautiful vision, but I have astigmatism. So you know how that can be when you can really see but you can't see.
Right.
It's annoying. And I'm like, okay.
Right.
I said, she must be used to driving this path to the hospital, because having a milky white substance across my sight would just Mm-hmm. I'd be devastated. I'd be like, okay, seriously, no. You know, mm-hmm. I would not be able to do what you did, because one thing that bothers me is the fact that I have, some days are better, like if I have a migraine, I really can't see. But
mm-hmm.
to be able to do what you did, that's something to be, you know, admired, because, you know, when my sight is off, I'm off. It just, you know, it's just not. And at night, you know, sometimes if I'm really feeling bad and I'm tired, and, you know, your sight gets worse, the older we get, it'll get a little worse. But then, you know, it's almost like I'm driving home on sonar or something, because I you know, but let me ask you this. Where are you now in all of this? Because after all of the needles and the sticking you in your eyes with the steroids and all of that, I just couldn't imagine a needle going in my eyeball, period.
Mm.
But, you know,
I just think about that, hearing you saying it. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm not. Look, I'm touching my eyeball up again. Ow. Oh, it's like, oh, gosh. Ow. But I could not do it. And I was talking to someone earlier this week, and I said, you know, she had to get these injections. And it happens that the person that I was talking to knew someone who also, I don't know what her disease was, but she said she was there when she had got the needles in the eyes and all of that. And it's just, oh, wow, it's just so much that you are a strong person, because, you know, most people would have just laid down and just given up and not moved forward with it. And you fought through this. You fought long and hard, because this thing would go away, or it would calm down, and then it would flare up again on you.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
You know, now is it still the same cycle, or has it?
Well, you know, actually, it has, you know, one thing that when you have a disease, I think,
uh-huh.
whether it's a mental disease or whether it's a physical disease, the
uh-huh.
longer you live with it, you learn its triggers. And for me, I learned that the trigger is stress. And because I'm an entrepreneur and I'm a diehard at anything that I do, I internalize stress. I don't think about stress.
Mm-hmm.
I don't act on stress. To me, stress is like breathing. And I view it as a part of just living. So I've been in, you know, some situations from a personal perspective and a business perspective that the average person would blow their brains out, I mean, within a second. And to me, it's just this water off my back. I don't really think much of it. And so what I had to learn to do was, is how to address the stress instead of just internalizing it the way that I was, because that's what would set it off. And so I finally came to the realization, I would say not maybe like between the middle towards the end of 2009, that the healthcare companies and, you know, all the businesses, you know, that I had owned, that I was going to have to give that up. And one of the reasons why I knew I would have to give it up, one, not so much as the disease, because that's who I am as a person. I am a writer. I am a motivational speaker. I love speaking with people and sharing my story of, you know, how you get to point A to point B with what you have. And so my passion had changed. And so the one thing about having a disease of any kind, not only do you have triggers that set it off, you have these indicators that let you know, okay, it's about to be set off. And so, again, stress was that factor for me. And the business that I was in was, I'd done state and federal contracting. And we provided community and residential services to individuals who were mentally challenged. And that within itself, it's just a stressful industry to be in for multiple reasons. And so I realized that, you know, here it is. I have this opportunity to write this book and become a full-time writer. I'm going to go for it. And so last October, I closed my company in Tennessee, and I have another one in Alabama. And I'm set to close it this September, because that is my passion, to become a full-time writer and, you know, and a full-time speaker. And so
right.
because I've made those natural transitions on my own, I haven't dealt a lot with stress. You know, I haven't dealt with, you know, even, you know, dealing with the fact of internalizing stress. I haven't had to deal with it. And, you know, until I did that, oh, I had flare-ups all the time. I mean, I remember one time I was at this, I was the president of the North Nashville Area Business Council with the Nashville Chamber of Commerce, and I was at a meeting, and a few people had, you know, gotten up to speak, and then it was my turn to get up and speak, and then I sat back down, and all of a sudden, you know, I could feel my eye throbbing, and within 10 minutes, my eye was bigger than my fist.
Mm.
It was that big. You know, and I went to, and what made me, because I could feel it throbbing, I could feel it sweating, and all of a sudden, you know, there would be two people staring at me, and then three people, and four people, and finally, a couple of people actually got up out of their chairs, and they said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, you know, I'm fine," you know, and so I went to the bathroom, and my eyelids looked like my lips. They were so swollen. And so I realized that, you know, if I don't get out of this, I'm going to be blind for real. So,
right.
I, you know, even though it's a situation and I can look back and say, oh, my God, you know, this happened to me and da-da-da, but I really don't look at it like that. I look at it as a blessing in disguise because it really pushed me along and helped me get closer to the things that I'm passionate about.
And, you know, a lot of people probably say, what? You know, but once again, some people, sometimes God puts these roadblocks in our way. So that it will either prepare us for something that's coming our way, it will help us, send us a lesson that we need to learn, or, you know, for whatever reason, or it helps us to be here to be able to tell our stories to you. And again, welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you so much to all of our guests. Hopefully the chat room issue has been corrected. So welcome to Guest 4881. Guest 5410, Guest 5459, and Guest 5461. And, of course, Miss Pretty, thank you all so much for joining us in the chat room. I'm so sorry for the technical difficulties. And, of course, to all of our guests that are in the call query, thank you for joining us here this evening. To our guests in the chat room, if you would like to speak with our guests this evening, you can call 646-478-4726 and press the number 1 on your phone to let me know that you would like to be on air. And if not, thank you so much for joining us here. And for those of you who have come in late, this as soon as the show ends, it will be available in the archives for you to listen to. And feel free to share the show with your friends and family and anyone you know may need this type of a uplift for this evening, of course, and beyond. So we're coming down the wire here. You know, that's the worst part about the show is when you have a wonderful guest and you're getting into great conversation before you know it, the time is almost up. But you have started so many businesses, and you sound like me when you say, you know, my passion is I want to be that motivational speaker. I want to take healing through her to a more national level. I always tell people, if you know someone who fits in with this show, put them in contact with me, because everybody has a story. And, of course,
right.
not every story is the same, but most people have a story that someone out there needs to hear. And with that being said, of course, to all of our guests, spread the word. And if you have a story, contact me and let me know. And also, let all of the listeners know where they can get a copy of this wonderful book.
Mm-hmm. They can go to my website, and that website is www.chitokaweb.com. And that's www.chitokaweb.com. And once they go to my website, they can click on, I think right when the website comes on, there's a book trailer that actually shows you a video of the book and what the book is about, a little bit about myself. And there's also a couple of tabs there that tells you exactly what the book is about. If you go, you can also click on the Where to Buy tab, and those tabs should take you right to the book itself. I know it does for Amazon, and I think Borders. The Barnes & Noble, you can actually go to Barnes & Noble as well. As a matter of fact, you can go to all of them and just put in Chautauqua Web, and the link will come right up once you hit the Amazon site or the Borders or the Barnes & Noble and so forth. If you put in Chautauqua Web or the name of the book, then that information will populate, you know, within the page. Also, it would be cool if everyone would go to my Facebook page and, of course, you know, press the like button. It's nothing like having people to support you. I always say that, you know, without the fans, I'm a writer, but with the fans, I am an author. And so, you know, you guys are what makes me an author and what makes, you know, this wonderful lady who's interviewing me is what makes her a host. And so so that's great, and I always love to get feedback and know what people thought about the show because I'm always trying to do better, you know, and you never quite reach that point, you know, where you can't learn or take in something new, but they can definitely go to the website. The book will launch, will be in stores nationwide July the 1st, which is right around the corner, but you can pre-order the book now on all of those websites, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and so forth.
And I just went ahead on and sent my friend request for you on Facebook as well. Of course,
thank you.
You know, with all of our guests, of course, Healing Through Hurt does, usually we develop a friendship outside of the interview. So, of course, you'll hear a lot more from Chautauqua outside of tonight, because I think that you're someone who I'd love to keep in contact with just to see how you're feeling, see what you're up to, see where you're going to be. If you're ever in Maryland or Baltimore, we definitely have to get together. You know, it's just wonderful to hear how you took something so, in most people's eyes, devastating as losing your sight, and you just kept moving. And I tell you, when you all get a copy of the book, you will see she kept moving no matter what. Nothing stopped this lady. Trust me when I said. And if you can imagine having to go to the hospital and your eyes are big as golf balls and they're poking you and they're prodding you and they're sticking all these things in your eyes. You know, most of us cringe at the thought of getting an eye drop, much less needles and other types of medications and things. But to keep going is just something to be admired and commended, because most people would give up. So this is very much an example of what you can do. And let's go back a little bit, because in the book you also had stressed that, you know, you were up against people who had all of their, as we call it, the paper. They had all of the degrees and they knew this and that. You were a young lady who came up from poverty, and even then they wouldn't even allow you to graduate from high school because of missing that one small point in, what was it, chemistry or something, and you had to even work for that right. So don't sit up here and say what you cannot do. From this point forward, to all of our listeners, get a sheet of paper, get a whole bunch of paper, get a whole ream of paper, sit down and start writing what you can do. First sheet of paper, put down what you would like to do. Second sheet of paper, or whatever number it's going to be on after you're done with your likes, is put down when you want to achieve that goal, whether it be 1 year, 3 years, 5 years. You put down every one, and then you get yourself an envelope, and you fold those papers and put them in a place where you'll be able to find them when that time comes around and see how close you've come or if you have achieved that goal, because that's how it all begins, is with some type of a plan, whether it be a divine plan or whether it be a plan that you've actually put on paper. Some people have been successful simply by walking by faith. Others have actually had a working plan. But again, as we said when the show first started, first and foremost, you need to know the business of your business and be prepared for those different scenarios and roadblocks that may come your way, that may be setbacks. But, you know, if you're going for fast money, you can lose it even faster. So you really should take heed to what you're hearing this evening. We have about, oh, goodness, 15 minutes left. So,
oh, wow.
I know, right?
It's like it went fast.
I know. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on here this evening. Again, when you get more speaking engagements and things, let us know. And, of course, her website is www.chitokaweb.com. I have put it in the chat room. And, of course, you all will be able to hear the show in its entirety. Welcome to all of the guests who just entered the chat room. Thank you so much for joining us here this evening. And if you did miss any of the show, once again, as soon as it ends, about 2 minutes later, you will be able to listen to the show in its entirety. And again, the name of the book is Something Inside of Me, How to Hang On to Heaven When You're Going Through Hell by Chitoka Webb. So where are you now? What are you doing as of today? I know that you're in the process you're closing some of your businesses down because you know what your purpose is in life, and you've made your mark in some of the industries that you started in. Do you still have your barbershop?
No, actually, in 2006, I retired from barbering, and I think that's I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think that's another important tool that we all must have in our toolkit if we want to be successful, is learning when to let go and move on to the next thing that, you know, God has so graciously given you. And that's the one thing I admire more, as you can see from reading the book, that I really admire Oprah Winfrey for many different reasons. But, I mean, even, you know, what she's done here lately with moving on from her show, I think it's nothing more rewarding and fulfilling when you can move on at the top of your game.
Right.
And so when I was, as a matter of fact, I know we don't have a lot of time left, but that when I had built my second barbershop, it cost me thousands and thousands of dollars to build a barbershop. Probably about 5 months later, I started feeling and hearing within that, okay, it's time to move. And it's like, what do you mean, God, it's time? I just spent all this money on this. I haven't even made the money back yet. But I was obedient to God, and I went from barbering to healthcare. Now I'm going from healthcare to being a writer, author, public speaker, and so forth. So it's also knowing when to move and knowing when to, you know, knowing when to let go. And each phase, you know, of my life, it has been the faith and assurance that I have in God that has really carried me through and carried me over. Because, you know, I heard this song, you know, years ago when I was in my early 20s, and I think it was a song by Shirley Caesar, I think. And in that song, she said, if God fails me now, it will be the first time. And that was the first time I ever kind of looked at the fact that, wow, God has never failed me. And so that's another reason why, you know, when it's time for me to go forward, I'm pushing the gas. So, no,
wow.
I retired from barbering December the 31st, 2006.
And I don't miss it
one bit.
Well, you know, that was your season. You know, that was your season and your time. And now, but, you know, again, that's something that most people won't understand, and that'll be for another show, but that was your season and your time. That was just one stepping stone in the bigger picture of your life's mission. And that was what put you on the path. And that's where you went. That was the path that God had paved for you. So you're doing what he wants you to do now. And there's one passage from your book, and I hope that I had copied it because this is strictly from my notes, where you had written something to the effect that your customer must complement your vision. And I think, in other words, it's not enough to just have a vision. And an entrepreneur must learn that it is not just people who make the world go round, but it is people who are like-minded that make your business go round. So I believe, now what I got out of that was that when you go into a business, when you start up a business, you want to have the proper clientele. You want to have the clientele that understands that they're there because you give good service and they want to give you their money. You don't need 27 people hanging around your establishment who aren't supporting you, who are deterring other potential customers from coming in because there's a whole bunch of slackers all over the place. That's not what you need. And so many people think that, oh, people may tell you, oh, you think you're better than us now because you're making it. You're not better than anyone. It's just business. There's a difference between thinking that you're better in business. So that's the word, you know, that's the word of wisdom for today. Walk by faith, keep the faith, but know that in order for you to be successful, you have to be surrounded by like-minded people from all ends, from the mentorship end, from the business end, from the colleague end, from the customer end. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's how you become successful. That's how you, if you want to be mediocre, if you want to be fly by night, if you want your business to be here, why do you come home and think that you have arrived bringing in $36,000 a year when you should be bringing in $136,000 or more a year? But you choose to live for your friends and whomever else you're living for. And until you decide, the queen bee doesn't live for the workers and the drones. They live for the queen. And she takes care and she keeps the hive together. But they live for her. She doesn't live for them. And in order for you to be successful, you have to get into that successful mindset. And whatever you choose to do, whether it be becoming a radio host, not everybody's cut out to be a radio host. Not everybody's cut out to be an author. Surely everyone is not cut out to be public speaker. But find your niche, find your calling, and monopolize and hone in, and you perfect that. And when it's time to move on, you will know. I started out in television. I end up internet talk radio and possibly expanding to, you know, regular syndication someday. But I love internet because I'm all over the place and I do things my way. So that's the difference there. But, you know, this has been a wonderful show. We have about 7 minutes left, and my goodness, I'll just give the mic to you, and you can give us some final thoughts and some final words of encouragement to all of the listeners, just to give them something even more positive to go away with.
Okay. Here's what I want to leave you with today. It's one word, and I want you to keep that word because you're going to need it. And that word is process. Everything you do in life, there's a process to it. So be patient with that process. Give that process time. And learn that you are always a work in progress. I don't care how many businesses you start, how many homes you buy, how much money you have, whatever the case may be, you are always a work in progress. About 3 weeks ago, I went to see my gynecologist for a pap smear. And this was the first time that I had ever seen this gynecologist. And here I am, a 36-year-old woman who is an entrepreneur,
author, public speaker. You know, I'm very diverse, been all over the world. Here I am, up on a table, and she has began the process of, you know, doing the pap smear. And she says to me, out of the blue, out of nowhere, we're about 10 seconds into the exam, and she says to me, have you ever been sexually assaulted? And my immediate response was, no, I've never been raped before. And I was puzzled as to why she was asking me that question. And I thought about it. I said, well, I've never been raped. I said, I've been molested when I was a kid, you know, when I was, five, 10, and 13, and 14. I said, when I was younger, I was molested. She said, then you've been sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. And it bothered me because I could not figure out how did she know that. I don't have any bruises, any cuts, or anything, you know, in that area. And how did she know that? And so she was very polite to me. She was very warm, very engaging. And, you know, when it was time for me to get up off the table, she reached out her hand. She said, would you like for me to help you up, Miss Webb? Now, here's a lady who's 20, 30 years older than I am. So she helps me up off the table. She says, I'm going to step out of the room. I want you to get dressed, and I'll come back, and I'll go over your exam with you. Mm-hmm. The whole time that I was getting dressed, see, this is the problem when you think you've arrived or you've made it to the top. God always has a way of letting you know that you are still a work in progress. So I get myself together. She comes back in the room, and I'm baffled at how she knows this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so I asked her the question. I said, how did you know that I had been, sexually assaulted sounds pretty strong for someone who's been molested, but that mm-hmm. is a sexual assault. Yeah. And remind you, this happened, you know, 20-something years ago. Yeah. And I said, what did I do? Did I move a certain way? She said, oh, you didn't do anything. She said, I just know. She said, it's obvious. And I was blown away by it. And then she says to me, she said, when I examine women, she said, the women who have not been sexually assaulted, they relax. And the women who have been sexually assaulted, they're tense. I didn't even know I was being tense. And I remember putting my nice suit back on and my heels and grabbing my bag and, you know, going to my car feeling like mm-hmm. I was about 2 inches tall. You know, because at the end of the day, and I say that to say, you can't hide from anyone. Right. And even if some things, even if you don't know, it's still going to show up. And I remember leaving that office that day and saying to myself, I am still a work in progress. And it kind of, you know, I got down a little bit about it because I felt like I thought that there was something that I had overcame. I thought that was something that I had dealt with. You know, I had went to see a therapist when I was younger. And then I thought to myself, process. Mm-hmm. It's all a process. Don't get all bent out of shape about the process. So that's what I would like to leave people, the listeners, with tonight. Is don't get all bent out of shape about the process. Go on through it. You know, you hit a roadblock, a stop sign, a yellow sign, a pothole. Go on through it. I think Winston Churchill has a quote that says, if you're going through hell, keep going. Keep going. Because whether you're 20, 30, 40, 50, 80, 90, you, as long as you're alive, you will always be a work in progress.
And that's beautiful. You took it right down to a few seconds, too. And just remember those words. And, again, thank you so much for joining me here this evening on Healing Through Hurt. And I will have you back again soon so we can finish this process. because this
Thank
is just
you.
The beginning of something great. And, again, my guest is in Chautauqua Web. You can check her out at www.chautauquaweb.com. Get a copy of her book because, trust me, you will get something out of it. And I want to thank you again, and you have a blessed evening. And I will be in touch. But thank you so much for joining me here this evening on Healing Through Hurt.
Okay, thank you.
You have a great evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We will see you all back here again tomorrow, 9:30 a.m. And again, we will see you back here on next week when the Men from Helping Up Mission will be back. And, of course, on July 2nd, my special guest will be Dee Wallace. And many of you all remember her from E.T. and several other movies, such as The Howling, and she's been on several television series as well. So with that said, we'll see you back here tomorrow morning for our Sunday morning meditation. Thank you for joining us here on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio.
Now I'm sad, you're feeling lonely. I don't know what I should do.